is Dave Pryor. Welcome to the Reluctant Agilist. Today I am here with somebody who has had a massive impact on my life, and I'm super excited that he's been willing to take time out. So Gary Gagliardi, did I get it right?
Oh, you did say it right.
I'm practicing. All right, thank you. So for those of you who may not be familiar with his work, there are a lot of people that have translated The Art of War. And I have a lot of translations of The Art of War in my apartment, but none of them has opened that book up for me the way that Gary's work has done, and specifically opened it up in a way that has allowed me to figure out how to practice it in my work, managing projects and working with other people. So first, thank you for that, for all the stuff you've done. But how do you describe to people what you do and what your background is?
Well, my background and what I do, what I've done is the same pretty much all my life. I'm a translator.
Okay.
All I do is translate. And I don't mean just translating from ancient Chinese to English, which, you know, obviously I did pretty well. But I try and translate like the language of war to the language of salespeople, or okay, the language of war to the languages of managers, or the language of war to the language of romance. I mean, the book itself is a very generic system about how you position yourself in people's minds.
Okay.
And, you know, all the systems work toward that positioning. And since, you know, we're human beings, you know, we naturally put things in a hierarchy in our brains. That's the way our brains work. And what Sun Tzu wrote about, he didn't write about any specific weapons or any of that stuff. He wrote about positioning, about how people think, and how the key to success is getting people to support you as opposed to oppose you. And what you're looking for is opportunities, openings to move into positions that people can support and can't attack.
So I usually tell people when I'm talking about this, like, you can practice this anywhere but in your marriage, but it sounds like maybe that's not right.
Actually, I've been writing a series of articles about intimate partnerships.
Okay.
Actually, my current Substack articles at, what's the name of my Substack? It's called Practical Strategy Based on the Art of War. Practical Strategy is the Substack name.
Okay.
But, got that for a second. But I'm doing a series of articles right now about what I call intimate partnerships, which is basically marriage.
All right.
And how they work and how strategy works within them and what you're trying to do in a marriage. I've been married, this is my 40th year, so.
Wow.
A little bit of
experience. Congratulations, that's impressive. Well,
and like a lot of people, I went through a divorce first.
Okay.
And so, you know, I know the wrong path and I know the right path. So it's, you know, okay, it's, once more, I translate, that's what I do.
Yeah. So a lot of people approach the work as if it's very conflict oriented. They get really hung up on the idea of war. I'm curious about how you discovered the work and how it made that transition from being like a military theory book into.
Well, I was a salesperson at the time.
Okay.
And I was working for a large consumer products company.
Okay.
And I'd been in sales for, at that point, like 3, 4, 5 years, and I hadn't been particularly successful. And I think my sister gave me a copy of the book.
You remember whose translation it was, the first one you had?
I can't remember. I've read them all, of course, by this time, and you know, all them. I wasn't impressed. You know, if you get them all, you go, well, this is so different. How's it so different?
Yeah.
That's why in my translation, I list the Chinese on one line with a character by character translation, and then the English sentence right next to it. I didn't want to add to it or subtract from it. In all my adaptions, I do the same thing too. I put a line of the English Art of War translation and next to it, the sales translation.
Okay.
But anyway, I saw that it was basically about the battlefield I was working on. I could see how to apply all those lessons to that. And I became fairly successful in product management. I decided, once more thinking in a framework of, you know, the most important thing you choose is your battleground. I said, well, do I want to be in project management? I want to have my own company. Starting a consumer products company is really bad, you know, really tough. And so computers would just become available at the time. This was the late 70s. And so I quit that job. And, you know, at that point, I was a regional, not regional manager. It was called a district manager.
Okay.
I had, you know, I was making a pretty good salary, but I left that basically and went to work in a retail Radio Shack store so I could learn the new technology. And, you know, I was promoted.
Wow. Okay.
And out of that, I wrote a series of fast and friendly guides for Bantam Books about computers. And on top of that, I left Radio Shack. I got fired from Radio Shack, really, but I think, or I quit. I can't really remember. But I wrote the series of books, and then I started, some of my friends from Radio Shack and I got together and started a company. One of those friends was turned out to be the woman that I ended up married. Okay. Our marriage was kind of a merger of stock. So we owned the majority of the stock in the company, but we started as a consulting company and became a custom developed company. And in the end, we became the leading accounting software product in the Unix marketplace.
Okay. And this was back in the beginning of computers for like, well, in the business.
This started, the first Unix computers that came out that were available for business were from Radio Shack. Mm-hmm. It's called the Model 2. And that's where you learned, you know, how to support multi terminals and all kinds of stuff like that.
Okay.
And anyway, so we started that, and we ended up developing primarily order software company for very large companies, companies like Motorola and Coca-Cola and people like that, that were moving from mainframe computers to the client server computing model. Ours was some of the first client server software. So,
okay. And
sold our company in the late 90s, about 96, 97, somewhere around there. And after that, I had the money to do whatever I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do was, that's where I did my translations of Sun Tzu's Art of War.
Okay.
Oh, I did the first adaptation for my salespeople at my software company.
Okay.
And so that's the way I train my salespeople to think about sales. And we became one of the Inc. 500 fastest growing companies in America. They wrote articles about our use of Sun Tzu's The Art of War. And I'd started doing talks about it with our corporate customers.
Okay.
There were, you know, large companies, and, you know, they were interested in teaching this to their sales and management. And so I wanted to do a better translation because all the, you know, so if you look at them all, they're all so different, and also, and you can't tell what's the author's opinion about what Sun Tzu said, what's his, you know, what Sun Tzu said. So I went back to the Chinese, and I've always studied languages all my life. And I was
okay. So you already knew Chinese before you went.
I didn't know Chinese before. I'd studied Japanese for about 3 years.
Okay.
I was familiar with they use Chinese characters in their written language. I actually got more into the written language than the speaking languages and almost everything. And at the time, actually, China was just coming onto the web, and they had all kinds of tools that aren't available now for translating Chinese. It was very helpful.
Okay.
And, you know, I was able to do a lot of research that I don't think you could have done before in doing a translation because of all the translation tools and historical tools. And I actually, later on, like in the early 2000s, I think I actually had help from Chinese academics as far as some of this stuff too. So my book was very well accepted actually in China, because they didn't like most translations. I stayed very close to the original, so the academics there kind of liked it. Anyway, I brought out my book. It became, you know, it won an award as the best multicultural book of the year.
Okay.
And I was speaking on all these companies and more companies. And I did, right after that, my new adaptation for salespeople. And I was speaking mostly salespeople, but they said, well, we got marketing people and they'd like a version. So I did a marketing one and I did a management one because these are the people I was talking to about. And I had done marketing and I'd done management.
Okay. What year, what like time frame?
I think my translation first came out about 98 or 99.
Okay.
Somewhere around there. And for the next 15 years, I spent a lot of time doing training. I built up a training organization. Actually, that kind of fell apart in 2007, which was the global economic, whatever they called it.
Yeah.
And because training was cut way back during that period. But I continued to do it myself. You know, I wrote a lot of books. I have about 40 books out there on Sun Tzu's The Art of War, a number of different adaptations, and then all kinds of stuff. You know, the playbook, which breaks it down into a lot of lessons. I was writing originally so I could do a college course.
Okay. And
that's where what I call the playbook came from. Is like it's a series of really 1 hour lessons if you're teaching.
Okay.
But anyway, then, you know, we traveled all over the world. My books were translated into a dozen different languages. The publishers in other countries would invite me to speak. And so we got a lot of travel. We did a lot of travel before with our company because we had offices in Europe and stuff. Now I traveled to South America where my books were pretty popular, and Asia where my books were very popular, strangely enough. And so anyway, it was a lot of fun for that period of time. Got kind of burnt out on it, but
anyway. If you met someone right now who is not familiar with it, how would you explain? I mean, how would you get their head past the title to be able to understand how to look at it from a different angle?
So funny because, we went to a lot of book shows because we were promoting our books. I mean, I won a lot of book awards. I won, I guess, 11 of my books got award recognition. And actually, to deal with that problem, because the book sellers are very, war, horrible.
Yeah.
It's like seeing a vampire, hold up a cross. So I did the Golden Key to Strategy version, which actually won a Ben Franklin Award as the best self-help book.
Okay.
And the way to describe it is basically the way the human mind works. And these days I write mostly about psychology and brain chemistry and stuff like that.
Okay.
To explain the underlying basis of the system. But basically the way the human mind works is we put things in hierarchies. We have preferences. Because you can't make a decision unless you know what your preference is, what you want. Mm-hmm. And people are, it sounds terrible, but it happens all the time. People are constantly putting everybody else in a rating system in their head. This guy's the smartest guy I know. This guy's the strongest guy I know. This guy knows the most about cars. And we have all these ladders in our heads. And the point of Sun Tzu's work is he didn't teach anybody how to use any physical weapons. He saw that competition was all about how people think. Okay. And people that won wars are people that were able to make moves that won more supporters and didn't create opponents. And that those that were able to win support from other people were the ones that won wars. It wasn't the biggest army. It wasn't the richest army. It was the army that was able to position themselves so that others could support them and nobody wanted to attack them.
Okay.
It's a very simple idea. You don't want to make enemies. You want to make friends. It's a very simple concept at its core. But the idea of positioning is a lot more complex than people think. There's a lot of ways, basic primary ways based upon our evolution, how we lived in nature, in the natural world, where we rate people and how we think about things.
Okay.
And Sun Tzu captured an awful lot of that in his work. It was, of course, he was dealing in life and death situations.
Right.
People, killing each other. So it was very important. And, my sense in reading his work is it wasn't his ideas alone, but these were passed down in his family, there was a class of people in China. Once more, I'm going to get into the history of China at the time, but it was called the Warring States period in China. And there was no empire at that time. This is pre-empire, but about 500 years, well, 300 actually, before. It's called the Warring States period. It was an era really of constant war, like Europe was for most of its history, you know, warring states. And Sun Tzu saw that it wasn't the biggest army. It wasn't the richest state, you know, and there was this class of dispossessed noblemen who became really a professional military.
Okay.
And I forget the name, the Chinese name for the class of people, but that's where Sun Tzu came out of, you know, and he worked as a mercenary for different groups of people. Okay. And he wrote this book, and he was hired by the Kingdom of Wu, and Wu was considered like semi-barbaric at the time. And during his lifetime, it became like the dominant kingdom in the area and was able to conquer, you know, everybody else because they were using this system. Okay. It was, you know, and so that's kind of the historical genesis of the system. And then it became popular in Chinese culture, spread through all the kingdoms. And for about 500 years, it was a broadly practiced system of thinking about competition in general. And then the upper class, one thing about this system is it's designed for people down here to move their way up, because it's all about advancing your position. And, you know, once the empire was established, about 200 years about the empire was established, the Chinese aristocracy said, we don't like all this social mobility. These guys are trying to work their way in, you know, up and be like us. I just like rich people today. Yep. You know, I think that rich people are trying to keep middle-class people down, and, you know, they're protecting their position. Yeah, exactly. They're protecting their position. But anyway, the Chinese did it by banning the book to everybody but aristocracy. And so for 2,000 years, it was basically banned except for aristocracy. And it actually didn't become available until, you know, the late 19th century. I'd say the mid-19th century, when it was probably made broadly available in the West before the East, because it was brought back by missionaries to China, translated. The title, The Art of War, comes from the French, which was the first translation. Mm-hmm. They adopted it from a popular work by Machiavelli that was called The Art of War. But anyway, more history than you probably want to know.
Well, do you think, so one of the kind of mindsets that I have about it is that it's really just, I explain it to people as a book about negotiation. So whether I'm asking you for the time of day or buying something, or we're actually, I would say right now, you know, Russia and Ukraine are negotiating.
Yeah. They're working things out.
Yeah.
Not in a great way, but they're working things out, or should be. You know, they call politics war by other means. You can also call war politics by other means, because it's all competition. It's all people vying for position.
Okay.
And Sun Tzu taught that the best way to win a position is actually not by fighting, but by establishing positions that nobody wanted to attack and others would support. You know, you don't go in. He said, a general that wins 100 battles isn't a good general. A good general wins without fighting. That's the whole idea of the system, is to win without fighting.
Which is weird, because it seems almost like people would question whether or not that general was actually any good, because they weren't fighting.
Right. You know, except if you can get bigger than everybody else and richer than everybody else, like he said, you know, the whole purpose is to serve the nation, not the army. You know, if the army is successful, the nation will be successful, and the army will have everything it needs. You know, one hand feeds the other. And this idea that Sun Tzu said, you can impoverish your nation by fighting wars. It was a purely economic strategy in his mind. He was saying it's too costly to fight battles.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't afford to do it. You'll run out of money. And he really saw that, you know, you got two people fighting and fighting and fighting. They're both becoming poor. What happens in the long run? Somebody else comes in and takes them over. That's what really happened in China. So they saw it happening.
Wow.
They started out with hundreds of little fiefdoms. It was city states. It was the era of city states.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the time of Sun Tzu's life, there was, I don't know, it might have been 7, 8, 9, something like that. It got whittled down to 6 later on, and then 3, and then there was only Qin left, and it became China. You know, it's but Sun Tzu saw this process where the city states were becoming bigger states because people were destroying themselves literally in unnecessary conflict. He defined conflict as trying to tear down the position of another rather than build up your own position. It's like you're a salesperson, and the way you're trying to sell is tear down your opponent's products. And Sun Tzu said, no.
Yeah, that's a horrible way to go about it.
That's not the way to sell. You build up your own products, make it different enough. You look for openings. You make it so that your product is filling an opening that your competitor can't fill. And that's the way you win the sales war, the marketing war. It's a very simple idea. Sun Tzu defines it in very specific and useful ways. You know, he breaks it down into the 5 major elements and talks about campaigns as 9 steps and talks about people's character and having 5 aspects that you've got to think about and many other things. But basically, it's a very detailed but well-organized system. And if you really understand it and study something about human psychology and how our brains work, it's really organized all around, you know, our basic nature, you know, as animals, and how we have to think in order to take everything into account when we're making decisions.
So all the things that you just said, it kind of challenges some of my original understanding, or I mean, it's evolved over the last 20 years or so, but the idea of creating chaos, the idea of appearing as you aren't, setting yourself in a position where they can't really see you clearly, and that would allow you the freedom to position things the way that you wanted to. There's like the deception part.
Yeah, the deception part is misunderstood largely.
Okay.
What Sun Tzu said is that people don't see things as they are. What they see is a perception. And what you've got to focus on is the perception you want to create.
Okay.
You don't, what you really are, it's not lying, because if it's a lie, it will fall apart. Lying makes you weaker. Sun Tzu put trustworthiness as one of the 5 major components of successful commander. And he did that because lying makes you weaker. If you try and build up your position on lies, it's going to crumble from under you.
Right.
You have to be honest about it, but you have to think about the difference between what people see and what you can help them see. You know, you're trying to reveal to them something different. You know, the whole idea of you want to appear close when you're distant.
You're far, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the idea is, well, we'll talk about it in sales terms. If you seem distant to a customer, you want to appear that you have more in common with them than they realize. And maybe you really are kind of distant, but you've got to think about things in a way that you see them from their point of view so you can describe them, so you can reframe them. I mean, that's one of the psychological terms that are used, is you have to frame the question correctly.
And that's like the salesperson not hearing no, they just hear that they didn't ask the right question yet.
Oh, yeah. No, sales is once more, actually, all of sales is really focused on the question and finding out the information so you can get into what the customer is really about. For two reasons, to save you once more, you don't want to fight any battles you're going to lose. That's just okay. Too costly. So you've got to figure out if you're really what this guy is looking for. And if you're not, point him somewhere else and don't waste your time. Because even if you sell him, if he's an unhappy customer, he's going to do you more damage than good over the long run. Okay. You know, you don't want any unhappy customers. What you want is repeat customers. Marketing is very expensive. And the way that you make any company work is have customers come back to you for more.
For more.
Okay. That's the only way that any business works, is repeat sales from the same customers. So if you can build up a base of customers, everything else gets easier as you grow that base.
Yeah. There's an element of some of the stuff you were talking about a few minutes ago with supporting the state. Like if you extend yourself too far, you're impoverishing the people at home and they're not going to support you and everything's going to fall apart. Right. But there's an ego element to some of this stuff. And I think also because I'm of a certain age, you know, it became really popular when Wall Street came out and they had that, I think it was the Cleary book that everybody bought.
Yeah.
But there's that whole, like, it's about me winning, not about me supporting, you know, that.
Yeah.
Getting sales to remember that it's not about them getting the ink. It's about taking care of the mothership.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of both, really, isn't it?
So much of that is misrepresented. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people that don't know how the world works and are still very successful because they're in the right place at the right time. Once more, it's all about positioning.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think Hollywood is a great example of people that are successful and have the capability of completely losing touch with reality.
Okay.
I think they think that things that are important aren't important at all.
Yeah.
And there have been, of course, you know, great movies that tell timeless tales, but that's because they get back to, you know, human nature and what's real.
Yeah.
But a lot of Hollywood is not real, and it doesn't even try and be real. And it's just trying to create action. It's trying to create, I mean, let's face it, what looks better on the screen, a bunch of people fighting or a bunch of people sitting around working things out? I mean, it's easier to write the first scenario.
Yeah.
It's hard to write. The really good writing is the second scenario, but you don't see it that much. I mean, lately, just speaking it out, I mean, every now and then I'm watching a show and I'm just amazed at the good writing. And where do you see the good writing? People are sitting down and talking over things and you know, working things out. I was watching, they have this series 1883, which is a prequel to Yellowstone.
Uh-huh.
A wonderful scene in there where, you know, they were talking about death. This woman has just lost her lover. And this other guy that's the leader of this wagon train, you know, before he went on this wagon train trip, he'd lost his wife and daughter to smallpox.
Okay.
And it was a very moving scene because the old guy is talking about how he talked to an Indian and how everybody you love has a part of you within you. Mm-hmm. And he was taking this trip. So the part of him that was his wife could see the
Bringing him, yeah, I think I saw that episode. Bringing her with him, yeah.
Beautiful writing,
yeah,
and the kind of writing that, you know, obviously the girl, you know, really got a lot out of that, mm-hmm. you know, that conversation, and you know, that guy has changed his position in her mind. Before then, he was just like the trail boss and whatever. Yeah. Now he's a complete human being.
A human being, yeah.
Very nicely done.
I was watching, I don't know if you watch the show Succession, but that
I haven't so watched lately.
The episode last night was amazing in terms of stuff like straight out of, I mean, because I'm thinking about it because of today stuff about, you know, how you show up, how you get them to come to you, how you put them off their game when they get there, things like that is brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it's all talk. There's no action, obviously. But some really good examples of that stuff.
But good writing about talk, about people putting things up, that requires skill. I mean, it requires a lot of effort. I'm actually working on my first novel right now. And I've been, you know, most of my books just took a matter of weeks and months at most. And like I said, I've written 40. And it's taken me 3 years working on this novel.
Wow.
Just now getting to a shape where I think it's kind of okay. You know, about half of it is kind of, I've still got to work out all the ending. I know what happens, but I haven't worked out the scenes. But still, it's so hard. So hard.
Yeah. Well, can I test something with you about my own interpretation? So I mentioned before.
You're wrong.
What's that?
You're wrong. I'm sorry.
if actually, you know what? I'm thinking about it, like, if I'm wrong, I'm totally okay with that. I would be completely fine getting this smackdown on this one.
I'm joking, of course.
Well, I wanted to, I'm trying to find the picture. So my book is, I don't know, like, can you see it in the camera?
Yeah, I do.
So obviously this is from the one that I wrote.
It looks like Amazing Secrets. It looks like Amazing Secrets.
And this particular picture of the five elements or five measures, that is the one that my brain exploded. And as a project manager, the way that I think about these things, this is what I want to test out with you. So, how do you explain this to people that aren't familiar with the five elements or the five measures?
I have a bunch of slides with pictures.
These are the things you have to know.
Yeah.
You have to study.
Well, actually, there's different ways I explain it at different times. I've obviously, Sun Tzu actually, once more, as I explain in that book, the Chinese did everything in pictures. That's the way they worked.
Okay.
And the pictures I have in there are actually from very traditional Chinese sources. The
plains,
all that kind of stuff. I don't know how much of that, I can get very boring talking about all that stuff. And it's, you know, more than you want to know. And once more, but all this stuff he's describing in his book, I didn't really get it until I started drawing pictures of because they're relationships.
Yeah.
It's all about the relationships. And the relationships are kind of, they're going to be described in a picture, but they're very conceptual and you have to kind of see what they're about. But the five elements, you know, it's just about nature. In other words, okay, you're an animal surviving in the wild. What's important to you? Well, the ground is important because everything that's food to you is on the ground somewhere. That's the only place you're going to find it. What else is important? Well, the climate, the weather is important. If it's raining, if it's cloudy, if it's night, if it's day, those are critical things. So you've got two of the primary elements already. Well, what else is important to you? Well, your personality is important to you. The kind of person you are is going to dictate what you're going to do.
Yeah.
And what else is important to you? Everybody else and
how they're going to do.
Work with them and how you deal with them. That's also important. So there's four of the elements. You've got methods, commander, the sky or climate, and the ground. And what brings them all together? There's got to be something joining them. It's called mission or your goal.
Mission. Okay.
What you want. I forget what I called it. I think it's called Tao in the original Chinese.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the book you're reading, what else I call it, but it's your goal. It's your shared values.
Okay.
The shared values unite you with the methods of other people. It's because what you're trying to do together. The mission also in some way is shaped by the climate, the things you're going through. And climate isn't only used by Sun Tzu or the ground used in a physical sense, but these things are built into our minds. We
come
from evolution, and so we're always worried about the emotional climate, the temperature of somebody you're dealing with. All that stuff is just built into our thinking. I mean, You know, I think that Jordan Peterson talks about, you know, lobster brains and how a lot of our stuff like dopamine comes from you know, can be traced to creates hierarchies, goes back to lobsters.
Wow.
It's true for all this other stuff.
Okay. You know,
these systems of organizing the way we see the world.
Yeah.
Go back to the foundation of life on Earth, you know, as we crawled along the ground.
To survival.
You know, looking for food. You know, that's all we're doing now is crawl along the ground looking for food.
All right.
That's where we find our resources, you know. And you know, the heaven is the sky is what, you know, controls our ability to see things and hear things and
all
that stuff. You know, it's a very deep system psychologically and very interesting.
So let me check in with you on this, because this is how I explain this to project managers. When I'm teaching people how to do project management, this is more traditional project management, but I think it applies in Agile for those of the people that are familiar with Agile as well. The things that I always start with are the climate and the terrain, because if you were in a battle, those things would have, like you just explained, they would have a significant impact on what you were doing. And if I walk into a new client, I need to understand the organizational structure, which I would characterize as the ground, and the climate would be the political structure, like who's got juice, who's rising in power, who's losing power. I have to be able to see both of those things and hold those together in my head to be able to understand some of the ways I'm going to be able to maneuver things or options I can create.
Yeah, I don't think the hierarchy is as much ground.
Okay.
The hierarchy is a little bit more ground. Hierarchy is kind of the shape of the ground.
Okay.
And whereas the feeling people have, you know, how optimistic they are, the shared feeling they have as an organization. An organization has a climate. It has an atmosphere.
Okay.
And it's really how people feel things are going, you know?
Yeah.
Same, you know, are we getting into winter? Are we going into spring? You know, what's going on here?
Okay.
And once more, you got to reduce it to these very almost primitive terms to really understand. You know, there are organizations that are going into winter or have been in winter for a while. You know, I've worked with some of them.
Yeah.
There are companies that are in springtime and, you know, everything is blooming and, you know, la-di-da.
Okay.
You've really got to know. And it's not the opinion of the guys on top, because they're a small part. It's really the base of the pyramid.
Yeah.
It really matters.
Cool. All right. So let me check two of the other ones. There is the way that leaders lead, and the way, like for me, I always think about it two ways. There is how I like to be led and how I lead. And some examples, I've had some leaders that I've worked for who were all about being in control of everything and running everyone and being in complete like dominance. And I don't work well in those environments. So I need to find an environment where I can function well with whatever leadership style is there. And then the counter to that would be, is this an organization that says we're going to do a thing and actually does the thing? That would be the discipline. Do they follow through?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because there's plenty of places that have those recycling cans everywhere and they're all filled with regular trash.
Of course.
So do those two hold?
Go through them again for me. So
sure. So the leadership one is, I'm thinking about that in two different ways. I'm working with a leader of an organization. What is their style? Are they very command and control? Right. Are they a kind of leader that wants consensus from everyone?
Yeah.
Do they think they're the second coming of Steve Jobs? That's part of it. But I also think about, for me as a person in an organization, how I like to be led, what makes me thrive. Like if I'm choosing a gig, that's important as well, because I have to put myself in a situation where I can do good things.
Yeah. Well, once more, what we're talking about now is the dichotomy between the two little wings of that diagram.
Yeah.
We're talking about your personality and how it fits with the methods of the organization.
Okay.
The methods of the organization are defined to a certain degree by the way whoever you're working with, it's whoever you're working with and whoever you have to exchange with, It's how they work and how that fits with you. Whenever I think about personality, I divide it into the five characteristics that Sun Tzu uses, which actually map pretty closely to the five aspects of personality that are what are popular in psychology today.
Okay.
You know, there are a few differences, but the differences, I think, Sun Tzu does better. You know, in psychology, one of those characteristics is called neurosis, how neurotic somebody is, negative feelings.
Yeah.
But Sun Tzu describes that as courage. It's how brave people are. So neurosis is a lack of courage.
Okay. And
courage is, you know, the bravery, being able to face things. And Sun Tzu taught that both those extremes are bad. In other words, you can be too shy about doing things.
Right.
Or you can be too aggressive in doing things.
Okay.
You know, it's about being in the middle.
And being balanced.
Balancing.
Yeah.
The whole system is about balances, though. Everything has an opposite, and the opposites must balance.
Okay.
And so it's all about, you know, you've read my book, so you know about complementary opposites.
Yeah.
It's all about all these complementary opposites and finding balance. And it's not in a, you know, some sort of, you know, unrealistic balancing of nature, you know, some beauteous sort of harmony and, you know,
yeah,
a new age kind of weirdness. It's in very practical ways. Things have to balance. Like I was just, like I said, I've been writing about intimate relationships lately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things in a relationship have to balance. You know, we learn how to work with other people, talking about methods and personality.
Yeah.
We learn that in our childhood. And we learn it, actually, we learn it at the age of three when we start playing with other kids.
Okay.
And what we learn is that if we try and make the rules, kids won't play with us. We have to let them make some of the rules. We have to make some of the rules.
Yeah.
We have to find a role to play that entertains them. And they have to find a role to play that entertains us. And we're playing together. And that's everything.
It's all collaboration.
That balance
of
entertaining each other and working out our roles with each other so that we're in balance.
Okay.
And we learn it in childhood. People, according to the psychologists, you know, if children don't learn that by four, they never learn. They're always going to be isolated and loners because they don't know how to do that balance.
Play with others.
But we have it once more each of us has to learn it. And we learn it because it's born into us.
Yeah.
You know, we have parents. Well, we do have parents tell us, you've got to share your toys. And we do have that. But most play between children that are three, they work it out for themselves.
Yeah, they have to figure out why.
And, you know, I remember my granddaughter saying, well, I don't like playing with her. She always has to do everything her way. You know,
it's
like, I don't want to play with that kid. And the same's true in real life, you know.
Yep.
If somebody wants to do it all their way, I don't want to play with that kid.
Yeah,
that's the way it works. But see, that's why Sun Tzu breaks out all these things, characteristics. So you kind of see what people are and what they need to balance themselves. Like in my case, and I'll just go to my marriage. Very creative guy. I'm a very quick guy. I do things very quickly. I tend to do a lot of stuff, but I'm not very detail oriented.
Uh-huh. And you need someone who is.
Yeah, my wife is very detail oriented. She always did the administration of our companies.
Yeah.
You know, she would take care of the inventory and the payroll and all that kind of stuff because when I did it was sloppy. Nothing dressed. Are more crazy than the way I would do taxes. Well, I haven't done taxes in, you know, 35 years because, you know, from her point of view, I mean, she looks for every penny.
Yeah.
You know, she's extremely precise. She obeys every rule. I don't even learn the rules. It's like, I don't read the manual that comes with the product. I'm sorry. I'm going to play with it and figure out how.
And figure out your own way. Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to know the rules.
Yeah.
Don't read them to me. I don't want to know about them. But, you know, our personalities balance each other. I mean, we certainly wouldn't have been as successful if she wasn't the way she is or the way that I am. And she can't do mine. She can't be me and I can't be her. you know, it's a balance.
And you create a system where there's support there. Okay.
Right. It's basically, you know, you've got to know your strengths and your weaknesses. And once more, Sun Tzu says this.
Yep.
And, you know, you base everything as far as building relationships upon what your strengths are, what you need to cultivate you, and so on. You know, it's, you know, everybody that I've worked with in partnerships, it's because I don't know. I could say I can't do things. I just don't want to do them right.
Yeah. That's what or the relationship.
Them, but I wouldn't do I don't enjoy doing them.
The relationship enables you to do what you like to do.
Right. And once more, I take it back to this childhood thing.
Yeah.
You know, we just want to do what we enjoy doing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're still trying to play all the time. Or should be trying to play all the time. And we'll do better in life if we do try and play all the time. You know, that's one of the things I'm emphasizing is, you know, things have to be fun.
Yeah.
You know, it stops drudgery. If your marriage is drudgery, you're not going to do
gonna
it.
Last.
You know, you're going to get divorced. You know, things have to be fun. Things have to balance out in a way that they make sense. And that's true for business relationships, for friendships. It's true for everything. You know, I mean, just
that's how we do it.
Works.
So, all right. So the last of the five measures is the Tao. And I know most of the books that I have translated as the Way, which I think for a lot of people doesn't help. I think of that as sort of the culture, like the corporate culture, but that kind of steps into what you were talking about as climate as well.
Yeah. Not only that, but it's mostly what they say about it, like mission statements. Because I described the Tao as mission.
Okay.
Mission statements are mostly bullshit.
Okay.
You know, the Tao is the goal, not the goal. It's
ideal.
It's the direction you're going because that's where you want to head.
Okay.
I guess that's the way I'd simplify it the most for the most areas.
Okay.
Is it's your values in one sense.
Yeah.
It's like, what am I working for? Am I working to support my family or am I working to buy a fancy car?
Right.
You know, it depends on who I am and where I am in life. What am I working for as the corporation goes? Am I trying to make us, you know, so we have the best product in the world, you know, something that's very technical. And, you know, I work with companies where their whole focus is on, you know, they want to make something that's a beautiful piece of engineering.
Right.
And you can never explain it to the customers because that's what they're not working for the frigging customers. Mm-hmm. A great example to me is Amazon.
Okay.
Amazon, when it started out, their focus was clearly on the customer and doing whatever the customer needed them to do.
Yeah.
And I think they've lost that in the last few
years. A little bit.
Where they're doing things because they want to do them. You know, I want to do. The whole woke culture thing is all people doing stuff because they want to do them and, you know, let the customer take it. You know, it's like the customer isn't going to take it.
Well, they have enough information.
You're going to lose your market share, you know.
Or they have enough data to be able to tell how many customers they'll lose and when, and they can play those odds.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
You know, that's what they tell themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're always wrong, but that's what they tell themselves. It's like all the experts.
Right.
You know, all the experts that say they can forecast the future and they're on TV all the time or news or whatever, wherever you get your news.
Yeah.
They're always telling us what's going to happen and they're always wrong. It's amazing. You know, I mean, we just lived through this pandemic nonsense. I mean, if that didn't prove the experts are terrible at predicting the future, nothing does. And that's why I tell people don't make plans, you know, that reach out years into the future because
you don't know.
Sun Tzu says, you know, the plans fall apart. The fact is, you have to deal with things as they happen. You have to be in touch with your environment. You know, you have to be in touch with the ground and the climate. Because it changes every friggin' day.
Yeah.
And when you make stupid decisions, you know, you can only make them for so long because if you're putting yourself in a bad position, you know, those positions go down. It can go downhill pretty soon. You know, I mean, it's not a there's no guarantee that where you are now is going to be
where you're going to be.
That's one thing Sun Tzu teaches very firmly, is because climate, that is time,
always changes.
Element of time is always changing.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to either be advancing your position or
retreating.
Maintaining it. You know, you've got to do both, actually. But
Okay. Advancing
your position is, you know, a very important thing. We've also got to do maintenance. You know, if you don't do, It's like anything. If you don't do maintenance on your resources, you know, they fall apart. You know, that's nature. Nature is always trying to tear down whatever you're building, whether it's a position or whatever. So you've got to be actively supporting it. You've got to be looking for support instead of opposition, because the opposition's out there because other people are working for their goals.
Yeah.
They're not working against you necessarily, but they're working for their own goals.
Cool. So I have one more thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is practicing this stuff. Because I've had jobs where I've had the opportunity, the freedom to make a point of like, I'm going to go test this in this meeting right now and see what happens. And I'd come up with different hypotheses and run them. How important is practice to really being able to work with this?
It's the only thing. It's a martial art. Actually, it's the foundation of the martial arts. I mentioned before that this was banned in China after 500 years. But it really lived on in the practice of martial arts. If you look at the full philosophical foundation of martial arts, it all comes down to Sun Tzu's philosophy. But it is a martial art, and you only learn it by practicing. It's like reading about karate. How good are you going to get? You're not going to get very good at all. You know, you've got to work it out daily, try and work on various aspects, work through various things, and it's a whole life philosophy. It deals with your relationships in business, your personal relationships, and you're working it out all the time. You know, you have a lot of opportunities to practice every day. Every encounter with everybody is an opportunity to practice. And it actually, the only way it gets good is if it gets into your gut, so that your gut instinct driving everything. You just have a feel for it, and that's just sort of what you naturally do. It's like being a salesman. You're naturally curious about what your customer is thinking. It's not because you've been taught to, you know,
go sell.
Just
what you do.
Which is, you just really want to know what he's about, what he's looking for, you know, why, what his problems are. I mean, if you want to help people, you want to know what their problems are. And you start, you know, you got to be curious. You got to care about, you know, once more, what are the five primary characteristics of a commander? Caring is one of them. Trustworthiness is one of them. Courage is one of them. And I'm going to forget the other two. But anyway, I mean, these are all important aspects.
Cool. Thank you very much. So if people want to learn more about you or your work, they can obviously buy your books. I'm going to link to your Amazon page here as well. But your Substack, they can check that out too.
Substack, Practical Strategy. Substack.com is the full Practical Strategy. Substack.com is the whole name. I do as much writing these days and more work these days. Actually, I'm still translating, but I'm translating the Greek of the Bible. Twice words. I've been working on that that's been a project I've been working on for about 15 years.
Wow.
And I have a website called ChristWords.com.
Okay.
And another Substack called Rediscovering Jesus, Substack.com.
Okay. But
that's the novel I've been working on. And that's where I work on every day. I work on that because it takes me about 2.5 years to go through every verse of Jesus's. And there's about 2,000 of them. And
a lot of work.
Every time I go through them, I know a lot more than I did before.
Yeah.
I'm getting back to, actually it's longer than 2 years. I haven't done Luke in a long time because I don't care for him. I got to redo Luke. I'm about to finish up Mark. Matthew's my favorite. I've done a lot of work there, and John too. But anyway, that's what translation I've been doing lately.
All right.
Greek. Well, so.
Thank you very much. And thank you for responding to my invite on LinkedIn. So this is a really big treat for me, and I'm very grateful for your work.
That's all right. Thank you. I of course love the attention, so it's nice, and it's nice talking to you.
Cool. Thank you. If you learn to work the old way, but the new ways